Okay, I think I heard a couple beeps, so I think everyone's been chimed in. Okay, today is May 23rd, 2014, and my name is Gary Corbett. I've invited really a good cross-section of what I would call the pioneers in course measurement and record keeping. I know my father thought a lot of the work that all of you have done in this arena, and certainly, I'm sure people through the years have given you a lot of thank yous because this is really so foundational for the sport to become legitimate. Here's a quote from my father. I rate my involvement in course certification the most important thing I've done in athletics, and that includes being on an Olympic team and setting a few American records. I want to thank Aldo Scandura for giving me a chance to survive, and I want to thank the late John Stirner and John Jewell of England, and also Robert Letson. In the case of Aldo Scandura, he was just background. He was the AAU long distance chair at the time of the starting of the standards committee. My father would consider John Stirner his mentor in this arena, and John Stirner was the first chair of the RRC Standards Committee in 1964. Certainly, the course measurement in the United States was modeled from the RRC of England and their best practices, and John Jewell. I haven't counted up all the letters that I had between my father and John Jewell, but they're at least 300, and I think it could be upwards to 500 letters that I have between their years of correspondence. Robert Letson, I had some contact with him a couple years ago, and he was invited, but he didn't chime in. But I know he thought a lot of Robert, and I've heard some of you speak of Robert also and his work in this area. And as I have each of you, talk about your involvement in this and things you're proudest of and such, I'd like you to raise up, other names of people that were instrumental in course measurement. My earliest memory of this, I was very young. I remember doing some measurements with my father, it was a string involved. I was holding a string or doing something with a string. Now, I was very young, but that's my first memory that I can trace back to course measurement. As I got older, I do remember helping my father with the calibration course, and I also remember doing some measurements. I think my mother, Ruth Corbett, was also with us at Van Cortlandt Park. The first measurement in the United States was the 1960 Cherry Tree Marathon in the Bronx, New York. And my father and I believe John Stirner did that measurement, and Aldo Scandura may have been along also. That course was found to be 3/4 of a mile short, and they used a measuring wheel. The we talked to John Stirner being the first chair of the RRC Standards Committee in 1964. My father was the first chair of the AAU Standards Committee started in 1965, and their mission was to certify the 5 junior national AAU and 5 senior national AAU championship races. In 1966, these two committees were combined. I believe the RRC committee went on to do more with standard certificate work for a while. And I want to also, before we get started, just note a couple of the earliest. Well, the first, this is according to an article written by John Stirner, the first certified course in the United States was in 1967, Washington Park Marathon in Denver. Some of the other early measurements were, I mentioned the Cherry Tree Marathon. But in October of 1965, the Yonkers Marathon was measured by my father and Aldo Scandura. It was found to be 13 yards short. And in December 1965, the Culver City Marathon was measured by Bob and Lynn Carman, a calibrated measuring wheel. And in April of 1967, Larry and Sarah Berman, along with John Boris, measured the Boston Marathon, and it was found to be 107 yards short. So I'd like to start with John, since John, you were started running sometime in the 50s, I believe, and I know you raced my father a lot, and you certainly were a champion runner for the BAA. John, why don't you talk a little bit about how you got started in course measurement and some of your memories of measuring courses.
First of all, I want to give credit to Larry Berman. He was really, he sort of fine-tuned things for me, showed me, the ropes, and so that, at least we knew what we were doing, and going out on the Boston course was good. I mean, we came to my hometown, we had a measured mile here already, and, we went over it and verified it, and he also, I don't know if it was common practice at all, but he showed a way where you could transfer that to the course you were measuring, find a good area to do the transfer of the mile, the calibration that you had, which saved you the trouble of going back to, where you calibrated your wheel, for the recalibration. I just got calls from various people to measure different courses. They would help me sometimes physically, or I'd be on my own some of the time, but get a little more confident as I went along. Most of the courses I measured were in Massachusetts. I think I went up to Vermont once and into New Hampshire, but doing the paperwork, it was we followed the process, the guidelines laid down by your father or the committee, in the standards booklet there, and occasionally we had to do the homework again, meant maybe even going over the course again or going over the details, but it was a good feeling when the courses were finally accepted, and you could pass it along to the sponsor, the director. That's another thing. I got to give credit to the directors. What they did with the shoestring budgets and all, you got to give them a lot of credit, keeping the game going, and, they did a lot. I don't know any race stands out, but there were a few that were interesting to do. It became, larger races later on. A lot of them had humble beginnings, but like the Tufts 10K, the woman's only race there. And I can't think of any to jump out at me. But one was the Westfield 10-kilometer race that was the first Masters race. It was sponsored by Otto Essig, who ran the Berkshire Industries business. And he struck his own medal for the race. He had his own medal that he made. And it was one of the first Masters-only races. But he came out on the course with me, and we measured it. And I remember when we came to the turnaround point, he said, well, actually, you're running a little further by making that arc as you turn. Right in there on the details, and that never would have occurred to me. But anyway, it was just a little memory. Again, the sponsors coming out, and hands-on, and
John, how big a problem was it, as a racer, the course is being not correct, accurate. How frustrating was that to you?
I didn't have to deal too much with that. I mean, these are races that some that were new, or I wasn't really had to deal with that too much, you know, as I remember.
How about as a competitor in the 50s and 60s?
You mean in that end? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think we had a sense of, you know, when they were short or long, you know, by the condition we were in, the times we were running, you know, it didn't bother me that much. But I think for the championship races, the titles, you know, good to know that those were on track. And I think I did measure a few of those, like Needham, that was a national 20 or 25K, I've forgotten now. But,
20K.
20 kilometers?
20K, yeah.
12. Yeah, 12 and a half, I guess. 12. That one was tricky measuring. I remember we went out and, you know, there was, we didn't have police escorts in those days. I mean, we could have, I supposedly, but, and, you know, it was falling along the car and the bike, and which is not the way I usually did it, but anyway, and your thing is you're dealing with traffic, and it may not be the ideal, you know, follow the course of the runner. There used to be that old guideline, 3 feet from the curb, but that didn't always pan out, so then I think they went to, you know, try to follow the course of the runner. But if you're making a left turn, you know, you got to be wary of traffic and everything. But there's a lot of averaging out, I suppose, but we tried to do that, I think, since we follow the course, the runner's path. And I mean, if you're making right turns, that's not a problem, but, you know, it's when you make those left turns, crossing over, you know, you're not going to keep to the right if you're going left. You know, you're going to either be in the middle of the road or veering left, one or the other, I suppose. But again, that's just a little side aside. But,
any questions for John? No comments? Okay. Okay, thanks, John. Ken, you, I guess, you know, what got you going with, you know, when it comes to record keeping, certainly you were a true pioneer in this arena. And what got you interested in record keeping?
Well, the earliest was when I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and I was running for the University of Chicago Track Club under Ted Hayden. And we had this handicap race, and Ted wanted to have a better way of doing the handicapping, so he knew that I was into computers and statistics, and we actually had computers back then in the 60s. But anyway, he said, why don't you gather some data, and you'll figure out what good handicaps would be. So I started collecting data, and I wrote to Runner's World, got a hold of Joe Henderson, and had him start sending me race results. And once I started getting these race results, I was thinking, gee, you know, we got 10 miles, 15K, things like that. The only rankings that were available in those years were marathon rankings, and there were marathon books that came out in the 60s, and Runner's World had a series in the 70s, but nobody's keeping anything for 10 mile or, you know, 25K or anything like that. So I said, well, gee, that'd be an interesting thing to do, so I started doing that. I have a penchant for numbers, but that sort of grew out of hand. The first rankings that the National Running Data Center produced were in 1974, which weren't actually published, but the first ones published were in 1975. We did that all the way up through the early 80s. That's basically why I did it, and got hooked. And, of course, going from there, I realized that many of the courses were not accurate. And so this is what got me into course measurement. First course I actually measured was for certification was the National Senior 30K Championships in 1973. And that one was a two-mile loop that we steel-taped. And I had put a team together and went out there, and we got a nice two-mile loop and ran the championship on it. But that was my first dealing with Ted, too. That's the National Running Data Center. That eventually was turned over to Basil Honickman in Santa Barbara, and then the national governing body. That's sometime in the late 80s. now I'm working with the Association of Road Racing Statisticians and doing pretty much the same thing except for the whole world and getting inundated with emails and so on. Your next item here is record-keeping controversial issues at that time. The big one was the point-to-point courses and whether or not they should be accepted for records. And, of course, the Boston Marathon people were adamant that the Boston Marathon, as being the grandfather marathon in the country, had to be considered for records. Well, Boston is a point-to-point downhill course. And on a good day with a tailwind, it's a definitely aided course. So that was a big controversy. What we did, actually, it was kind of interesting because once I started gathering all this data, Bob Campbell, who at that time was the men's LDR chair for the AAU, he appointed me as the record keeper for the men's LDR committee for Broach. And so I was gathering all this data and, you know, giving Bob all this stuff. And then I got a call from Bob Hirsch one day, and he was the chair of the records committee. And by this time, AAU had morphed into the Athletics Congress. And he suggested that, you know, we had a long talk and by phone, and he suggested that I draft a set of rules for road record keeping for the for TAC, which I did. And of course, one of the main things was how do you, you know, what do you do with the point-to-point courses? And we knew that it had to go to before the national, the General Assembly to get passed. And that meant you had to get a majority of the votes. And we knew that the Boston Marathon people would be against it if we completely eliminated point-to-point courses from consideration. So we actually had a two-tier setup, which were record quality courses, which had the main status as records. And then we had a secondary category, which was, included the point-to-points, and we called them best rather than records. And we did get the rules passed. There's a problem also, controversy. I started out defining a point-to-point course as anything with a more than 10% separation between start and finish. And that was not very popular. So I did, Bob, in fact, one person we should recognize is Bob Bommel, who did a lot of measurement work in Oklahoma back at this time. He was also a very good technician. And he did some analyses on the effects of wind on point-to-point courses. And I did a similar set of analyses. And between the two of us, we came up with the 30% separation as being the maximum allowable separation to be a record-quality course. And that was actually, that was written into the rule. The net drop of 1 meter per kilometer was not very controversial. It actually came from looking at the requirements for the allowable drop in 100-meter dash. Now, I relied a lot on the existing rules of record-keeping for track and field, and got several ideas from that as to how we should structure the road records. The validations came from the idea that the track and field had a practice when you have high jumps and pole vaults, you measure the bar before the jump, and then if a record is set, you measure it after. And I thought, this is a good idea. And we can use this in road running, and we can remeasure the course by an independent expert after the race has been run and validate the records. And that's where the validation practice came from. I think one of the biggest things that affected record keeping that Ted Corbett, was the four-course prevention factor. And, you know, we sort of accept this now as being obvious, but at the time it was not. At the time, we tried to get the courses as close to the race distance as possible. But this is in disagreement, really, with what a record is. A record is a statement that the runner ran at least the stated distance and not more than the stated time. And Ted was really the first person that recognized this discrepancy. And this, I think this is what gave him the idea for the short course prevention factor. So when we measured a course, we were ensured that the course was at least the stated distance. And I think this was instrumental in bringing legitimacy to road record keeping. and was one of the main reasons that TAC did adopt road record keeping rules. Another nice thing was that when we formulated the rules for record keeping, TAC actually let the technical people do all the drafting of the rules. There's very little political consideration except for the problem with point-to-point records with Boston. And of course, you know, the secondary records for the point-to-points were dropped after a few years, so you know, we got the good sound technical basis for the record keeping. Let's see, the last one you have in here is road chimes kept to tenths of seconds. That was the one thing I really should have done, was to have written into the record book or the rule book that road times would be kept to tenths of seconds. And I really regret not having done that. Short-sightedness on my part. If we had done that, then the world record for 5K for men, 13 flat, would have been resolved. You know, the times are 12:59.5 and 12:59.6. And there's a current tie for the U.S. men's 25K record, which would likely be resolved if we knew the tenths of seconds, which I haven't gone after those yet. And also, I've done a study comparing chip times, times from a printing timer, and handheld watches. And the results of that study were that chip times are reliable tenths of seconds. So that's I guess it covers pretty much everything you asked me to talk about.
In terms of to summarize your accomplishments, what are you most proudest of? If it was just one thing. Or a couple.
I don't know. I'm so busy. I don't even think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, drafting the records, you know, the rules for the record keeping, that was a major thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Just collecting data.
Yeah.
I do anyway. It's
okay.
Trying to make order out of chaos.
Yeah. Talk about Jennifer's role with the data center.
Yeah, Jennifer was very instrumental and had a lot of energy. She was very supportive. She came up with the idea for the NRDC News and basically was the one that put out that. And, you know, accompanied me to all sorts of things and just gave her support. You know, she's couldn't have done. And also, the other thing that Jennifer really helped on were the course measurement book and the book we did on race finish procedures. And the race finish procedures, we, you know, held that in Tucson in our house. And, God, who was there? Paul Christensen, David, you were there. God, who else was there? I don't even remember now. Jennifer would remember. I remember times and races and dates and things like that. And I don't remember other stuff. But anyway, that was a very large aspect of it also, and Jennifer's very instrumental in doing that and helping with editing the book and both books and getting those out.
Right.
I mean, I couldn't have done half the things I did without Jennifer.
Right. Questions, comments for Ken?
This is David Katz.
Hey, David.
How you doing? I think the last time we met, Ken, we were in a fight, so I don't want to start another fight. Just FYI. Just FYI, as a timer for the past 40 years and as a transponder timer, there's only one system in the world that gives you accuracy to within a tenth of a second with a chip or transponder. You are recording times to a tenth of a second, but they could be anywhere within a second plus or minus 0.5 to 0.9 being inaccurate. So just FYI on that, and that's a proven fact.
Okay, that's experience with the study I did.
If you ever have a separate discussion on this, I'll be more than happy. The only ones that give you the accuracy that adds to one tenth of a second is an active transponder, which is only used in the Olympic Games.
Other questions, comments for Ken? Anybody? Okay, thank you. Alan and Klain, Klain, I at first said, I think I told this to Alan, that as I was sorting through My father didn't throw anything away, and so I'm sorting through letters and organizing the measurement information file. I first thought that Clayne and Allen were one and the same. You may have been in the same city, I guess, which prompted me to that. But it's in reading further, getting ready for this call, I now understand, Clayne, your role early in your life with the Jones Counter. It kind of reminds me of learning about Bob Anderson later on that he was just a teenager when he started distance running news. So, Allen and Clayne, talk some about the Counter, Jones Counter, and briefly just a little history about the business.
Okay. The history of Jones Counter is pretty well documented online, which I sent everyone a link to. Mm-hmm. But let me start with a segue from Ken's comment about the Boston Marathon thing, because at the time of the 1 meter per kilometer drop, Boston was rather upset. And Bob Bunnell, who Ken also mentioned, being a mathematician, he came up with a mathematical formula. Because Boston said, well, we've got these uphills that make it harder, and it doesn't compensate for the downhills. And also, Bob had a formula that took into account the uphills and the downhills. And I went to the USGS and got four topo maps to cover the Boston course. And I just about went blind reading off the height all the way along the course. And then I applied it to his formula, and it showed, yes, indeed, as Ken says, the course was definitely aided. Okay, on the counter, it also is mentioned in the history that at the time TED was not requiring a post calibration, and the first measurement I did, he invalidated because I hadn't stretched the tape. Then a year later, I did it again, and this time I did a post calibration. Just seemed to make sense, and my two measurements were about 30 yards off, so TED rejected that one. And I don't know how soon after that started to become a requirement. And, of course, it should be. Things can change. Third measurement went okay. Anything to do differently? Yeah, Clayne and I would have charged a lot more for the counter. We were basically doing it as a community service. Clayne was making $1 on each one he made at the time. Other than that, now... You asked the question, how did Bob Letson impact your business? I'm going to turn it over to Clayne because he's the one that dealt with Bob during that. What? Any comments, Clayne?
I just remembered he ordered probably on the order of 40 or 50 counters, which was our biggest supplier, and he would then turn around and sell those to people primarily, I believe, in the California area. The one thing I remember about Bob was sometimes, because he put in big orders, I would get behind and get a little stressed out, and sometimes he was the one knocking on the door saying, I need these sooner than later. So I remember not especially liking getting letters from Bob, because I'd go from being caught up to being 10 or 15 counters behind.
Clayne, talk about your age when you were doing this, and how you were helping in the production of the counter.
Yeah, so when I was 9, my dad told me this story where he had been asked to make something like 30 counters for TED, and so he asked me if I wanted to make these for him. And so my memory, at least, and my dad can correct me, was that I did all parts of the construction, and so that meant cutting off the gear, filing the Vita Root counter, wiring them up. I dealt with the suppliers of the gears and the counters, and dealt with the customers. So there might have been a little transition period there when I was 9, but I'm pretty sure by 10 I was doing everything, which in retrospect is pretty amazing that my father trusted me that much to take on a whole business when I was that young.
And I didn't realize at the time, he tells me now, he was very happy when an order came in. I guess he liked the money that it represented. Of course, he charged more than a dollar a piece a little later, but it was part of that was absorbed because the price of gears pretty much stayed the same when you could get them, but the price of the counter kept going up, and I don't know what it costs now for the Jones Regal one. You asked what's the difference between Jones counter and the Veeder-Root counter. The Veeder-Root counter was a star wheel affair. It had a little knocker on one spoke, and so it gave one count for every revolution. So it wasn't a very good resolution. So the resolution was increased by counting the spokes past the last click. And this is kind of humorous because obviously you're having to deal with fractions, because when I presented Ted with the Jones counter, which was giving a click roughly every 4 inches, Ted was concerned about the big numbers people have to deal with. Well, I felt the big numbers were a lot easier than dealing with fractions. And not only that, this, we're talking 1973, the little handheld four-function calculator was becoming available, and that made the computations not be a problem with those big numbers. And one time, I think it was, Jones, Klein got a bunch of counters, and I think there was a six-digit one in there, which we didn't win order. And so Ted got very excited about that. He said, oh, we'll get more. You know, he thought that'd be good because our marathon wouldn't turn over. The other thing happened, these counters were designed for a 20-inch bicycle, and it gave 20 clicks in one revolution. And one time, Klein, in the box, there was one for a 26-inch, so it would give 26 for each one. And Ted was all excited because this would get better accuracy. And I had to point out, no, this doesn't get better accuracy. It gives better resolution, but it doesn't increase the accuracy. You also asked about the Schenkel assembly. I know nothing about that. Does anyone on call know what that was? And during this time, Ted wanted Klein to make up 30 counters till he had some manufacturer lined up to make something. And after the 30 were gone, he wrote to me again and said, hey, could we have another 30? I'm still working on this other thing. But it never came to fruition. Does anyone know about the Schenkel assembly?
The paperwork I have, I know it said $60 compared to Jones counter, $17. One
That's
document.
Right.
You know, but
and there was another one that was based on a car odometer with a flexible shaft, but I don't know if anything came of that.
Anybody on the call have any information on the other counters like the Schenkel and the car odometer? Okay. It appears that was the perfect product for this need.
Well, the fact that we invented it about 40 years ago, and it still seems to be the only really universally recognized thing out there, I guess so. I'm very proud of it, and I know Klein is too.
Something that you might not know is that there was a little ad in the back that we didn't place in the complete book of running by James Fix, and my sales jumped from about 100 per year to 400 per year because of that little blurb. And all I remember it saying was a bicycle odometer, and then in parentheses he wrote a good one, and we didn't even know he had put it in there, but all of a sudden we started getting four times as many orders per year. And so that was nice for my bottom line, and it really, I think, coincided with the running boom in the 1970s.
And during that time, Klein got behind because there was a strike at the factory that made the gear, and he was, like you said, he was getting these calls, where's my counter, where's my counter? And finally, the gears came in, and he went down and made some, so I decided to help him out. I went down and made one for him, and he took a look at it, and he studied it, and he says, that's okay, Dad. I'll make them.
Klein, let's walk us briefly through the years of your taking over the business and then selling it.
So I started the business when I was 9, and so I was born in 1964. So that was 1973 when I took over the business. I believe it was 1977 or 78 when James Fick's book came out and really spiked the numbers. And then I went to college in 1982 and realized I probably couldn't make counters in my dorm room, and so I sold the business to the New York Roadrunners Club for $500, and that was the last I worked on the business.
Okay. Alan Steinfeld, who was supposed to be on this call, came up here with Bill Knoll from New York City, and Klain showed Bill how to make a counter, and Bill made a counter, and it was very good, and they jumped in the car and went back down to New York City. And that was how it was transferred.
Okay. I did that summer, though, after my first summer after freshman year, I did measure courses, and I believe I measured 6 courses and got paid for that, and did that with a friend of mine. And so I did continue on with the course measurement business for at least one more year.
Wow. Great, great. Any questions for Alan or Klain? No comments?
And I just want to add that Pete Riegel really should get a hand for when the gear wasn't available anymore. He stepped in there with his son and figured out a way to make one so that this would not be a supply problem in the future, and still going on. And even though it was quite a bit different, he still calls it the Jones counter, the JR model. I appreciate that. Anyone else?
Okay. Thank you. David, I've observed you over the years. You've been champion of this, certainly, like everyone else. And I'd like you to, I guess, to first talk about, what the things you're most proudest of in this arena.
Well, the thing that I'm most proud of is knowing your dad. I think your dad was the most amazing man that I've ever met in my entire life. He had the most influence on everything that I do in this sport every single day. To me, as I told many people, I think I told you on the phone, that he was the smartest man I have ever met. And the reason why he was so smart was that he knew what he didn't know, but he knew who to ask. And he invited me in the late 70s to be a member of the AAU Standards Committee. And the protocol at that time was he would receive information and then he would farm it out to members of the committee for their opinion. So there was no ego associated with your dad. He always looked to find the truth, the right answer, wherever that might come from. And I was just going through a box of papers, because we all have boxes of papers from Ted, the amazing letters that I had received from him, correspondence. So I've been in this business, timing races and measuring courses, since the late 1970s, and everything I do is with Ted in mind. It sometimes gets me into a lot of problems, a lot of conflicts, because being kind of dogmatic, but I've learned from the other great men that are on the phone here, from Pete and from Ken and others, how to move forward. So my most proud moment is knowing your dad. So it's he's had the most influence. I've got to work with all these men who are on the phone here. I think they're all giants. Ken, even though we've had our battles, I mean, he moved the sport forward as far as record keeping. I was a member of the NRDC. I think one of the things I'm most proud of is doing some of the first validations. Is that correct, Ken?
That's right, down in Florida.
And also, too, I think I did the first pre-validation. What had happened was Jones had set the world record, or the world best, because world records were not accepted until actually pretty recently, out in Chicago. And I went out there on the Monday and remeasured the course among a lot of traffic. They shut down the city for me on that Monday to remeasure the Chicago Marathon. And we decided that for the following year that I would go ahead of time and measure the course in advance and ride on the lead vehicle. And if they did set a world best, we would be able to sign it off right there on the spot. So I think that was one of the first pre-validations that was done. Ken, would you you might know more about that than me.
That's the first one I remember.
So that was back in 1984 or 85. I think one of the things that stands out most, not about me, but a turning point in course measuring, was the measurement of the 1984 Olympic marathon. And I think this was a very important moment in time for course measuring, because we all had learned how to do this measuring stuff by correspondence with TED. A few people had gotten together in different parts of the country. California had a good program going on. You had great measures out there with Tom Knight and Scandera and others working out there and Letson. But when we got together for the 84 measurement, the Olympic measurement, I think that was really the first time that we all got together and realized that we were doing the same thing. And, you know, the great work by Riegel and Letson and Baumel and others putting together a historic document really set the standard. It was like the Bible for how courses are to be measured in the future and the documentation of it. The other part, as far as the history of course measuring, it's really interesting listening to Klain and Allen, you know, about the Jones count and now the Riegel-Jones counter. If somebody asked me what has changed in the past 40 years since we started measuring, well, nothing. We're still using this little simple mechanical device mounted on a bicycle. We're still doing the same type of calculation. But the only thing that really has changed is the clarification of where we are measuring on the road. And that took some time. You know, going from the prudent path, which was the term that your dad would use all the time, the prudent path of the runner, to being a meter from the curb, to being 30 centimeters from the curb, which we've been doing now for quite a while. So to me, that's the only thing that really has changed. Where are we measuring? As far as record keeping goes, that's a slightly different area. And, you know, we've had changes in that. So it's kind of fun being part of this. I'm very, very proud of what I have done and working with these great men and women. Now we have women measuring, which is a great thing. So I did write an article for Ken on course measuring back, I think it was in the early 80s. It was a two-page article that unfortunately got published around the world and helped help people learn about course measuring, which I was pretty proud of. So, and after that, I was the official measurer for the London Olympics. I know Pete was the official measurer for the Atlanta Olympic Games, and I recently been named to be the official course measurer for the Rio Olympics as well. So that's my story.
Congratulations. David, you know, doing a sort of what would you do different based on what you know now if you knew it back then, just anything?
I wouldn't do anything different. This is one of the greatest activities a nerd can have, because when you go out there to measure, it's you. And it's your mistakes, it's your successes, and you are totally dependent on yourself to make this thing work. And it is one of the most rewarding activities to do when a course works and the numbers work out and you hit it where you're supposed to hit it. It's a wonderful, wonderful activity for people like us. And I have never been a very good administrator. I mean, people like Riegel should get Nobel Prizes in this sport for what they have done, and Ken for making this not only work, but making it administratively successful. And they're the ones that are really the true heroes, along with your dad.
Yeah. Well said. The 1981 New York City Marathon, what's the Cliff Note version of this for someone years from now to understand what happened there?
The Cliff Notes version for that. There's going to be several different opinions about that on this call. Right, Ken?
That's right.
And I have a particular opinion, and Ken has a particular opinion. And the Cliff Notes version is the parameters adopted by Ken and the National Running Data Center would find the 1981 measurement of 1981 course short by those adopted standards by the NRDC. There's a lot of stuff between those lines that I just said.
A lot.
And personally, my personal point of view, which Ken will always disagree with, by the standards at that time, the course was accurate. That's my opinion. And it's almost the same thing as saying, and I'll give you an example, 2 years ago in Daegu, Korea, at the IWF Congress, and by the way, I'm a member of the IWF Standards Committee, so I get to help propose rules and regulations which have been voted on by the Congress. They voted saying that they would only accept women's world records from women's events. Fortunately, the IWF has turned around and changed that. Now they have two standards of events. And there was a lot of uproar at the time whether or not they were going to throw out Paula Radcliffe's world record of 2:15 from London. And there was a lot of press about that. And nobody from the IWF thought that was going to happen because you can't do that. You cannot change a record based on a new rule. Otherwise, we'd have different records for the pole vault because we changed the length of the pegs. We would have different records for the sprints because we changed the false start rules. So the rules that were in place at the time are the rules that the records should be applied to. And Ken, I'm sure, would disagree with that, but I don't want to get into an argument. That's just basic decency of the sport. We change rules all the time, but we don't go back retroactively and change records.
Let me add a postscript to the. Oh, go ahead. Let me add a postscript to the 1981 New York Marathon. I was introduced to Alberto Salazar out at the Portland RRCA convention, and he said I was introduced as the inventor of the Jones counter. Of course, Alberto Salazar had no idea what a Jones counter was, and a fellow tried to explain it to him, and they finally a light went on. He said, "Oh, so you're the guy that cost me my world record." And then a year later, I saw. I won't get there. Go ahead. And do you have anything to say?
Yeah. My understanding was that the New York Marathon course was measured according to the old rules, but in the Central Park, it was measured in the bike lane. I was there in 1981, and I saw how they ran, at least the parts I was observing, in the park, and they were using the whole road. I suspect this is where most of the shortage came from. So the idea that the course was actually measured according to the rules at the time may have been true, but they didn't run the course that was measured. That's
I'd like to interject something here, if I may. This is
Steve. Let me go back a second. I do an awful lot of measuring in Central Park. I'm the official measurer for the New York Roadrunners. And the segment that they ran in Central Park, which was less than 2 miles, you would not have gotten anywhere near the difference if they ran down the center of the road or ran down a lane, because I measure all the time there, and some of the races we have are in 2 lanes, 3 lanes, 1 lane. So I'm very familiar with the measurements in Central Park because I'm there almost every night. So regardless of they ran down one side or the other, wherever they measured, it does not account for the difference that you're talking about. And that's one of the biggest problems. And Gary, this is, again, one of the biggest problems that we have always had in measuring, and I think the other gentleman on this call can also agree. Not only where you're measuring, but the defined course. I think that has always been a problem when we are certifying a course, to have a defined course, and then the documentation defines that course, and then hopefully the race runs that defined course that we measured.
This is Josh Nemser from the BAA, and as a race director, race manager, somebody who designs courses, I've often thought that the collaboration between the course designers and the course measurer certifiers is very important to be involved in the measurement and the certifications, because exactly as David is saying, you have to measure the course that's going to be run in the way that it's going to be managed, curb to curb, center line to curb, whatever it might be. So that's where I've always found just a great collaborative effort between the race management side of the house and the course measurer, course certifier side of the house.
On a separate topic, just quickly, Ken, the people who were there with you who wrote the book, The Finish Line Manual, was Paul Christensen, myself, Judy Stelpe, and Jennifer, and you.
Who is the third person?
Judy Stelpe.
Yeah. Who is before that or after that?
Paul Christensen, myself, Jennifer, and Ken, who was the five of us.
Oh, okay.
We spent a weekend in your house.
Right. Yeah, I remember that weekend.
Yeah,
that was fun.
Any last comments about 1981 New York, and we'll move on.
I have one comment. As I recall, this is Pete Regal, as I recall how it went, there were no records before the Salazar run came into consideration. And when TAC was getting ready to come out with a complete set of road records, there was some talk of using the old way of doing it and allowing the Salazar record, and it was pointed out that it would be dreadful to start off a new system of records with a marathon record on a course that it was known to be short. And that's how I remember it. I don't remember anything about that, but that words like that were spoken. And I that's all I remember about this. Well, there's a lot I remember about it, but I'll shut up now.
I'm sorry, Pete. Let me just add one final word on this topic, because I have a tremendous amount of documentation, and this is something that irritates me tremendously. And again, I don't want to start a fight here, but Ken, you do tremendous work with your website. And all around the world, if you go and look on websites and you look at the progression of times for the marathon, the only one that's missing from there is Salazar's 208.13. And it's just taken out. It's not even listed. Whereas you have all these times going back for 50 years prior to that time, for 80 years, and we don't know the accuracy of any of those courses, but we've decided, or some people have decided, to remove Salazar's time. And that's just plain wrong.
Well, let's...
Pete is right. You don't start record keeping with something you know is short. And
right.
The New York City Marathon
right.
came out to be 150 meters short.
150 meters short by what standards?
By the standards that we used at the time.
The standards that you set at the time that were not adopted until the following year at the TAC conference.
When was the validation measurement actually done?
The validation measurement was done in 84 and 85.
Why did it take so long to get a validation measurement?
Beats me. I was not an administrator of the New York Roadrunners.
I know. I couldn't get the New York Roadrunners to agree to validation because they knew the course was short.
My understanding of that was that attempts were being made to get a validation, but nothing. They couldn't get the cooperation of the New York Roadrunners, and finally they said, TAC said, that if it's not done by the end of 85, forget about it. We'll just write it off. So Tom Knight went out there in 85, measured the course, found it short, and that's where it landed.
Right, exactly. Tom Knight stayed in my house here. I measured it with him. But all I am saying is the rule that you passed could not go retroactively back and change a performance.
Well, I think we're getting a little off. Yeah. We're getting a little too deep into this topic for the time we've got available.
Okay.
Sorry, Peter. My mistake.
That's okay. We'll move on. Pete?
Yeah, this is Josh Nemser. I'm going to have to jump off in a couple of moments. Can I just have 2 seconds? I'm sorry if I'm going out of order for just one moment.
Sure, go ahead. Go ahead, Josh.
Thank you. I also want to recognize the efforts of all the pioneers on this phone call. I had the great opportunity, Alan, I don't know if you remember, I sat next to you at a luncheon at Running USA a couple of years ago when you were honored with their Trailblazers Award, one of their awards. So I've benefited so much from all the work that men have done, women have done on this area of our sport from the 60s on. I've been involved in the sport for the last 30-plus years. I've been fortunate to work with the marathon for the last 20-odd years, and it's been fascinating to hear about some of the early measurements of the marathon course in 1960, Larry Berman's name coming up. And so it's great when you think about the continuity, and as David Tate said about the standards that were in place years ago still in effect today. there's nothing better I can do than to give my customers, the folks who are coming in to run our races, the just satisfaction that you've run an accurate course and the timing is going to reflect your efforts over that accurate distance. So I think that what we have in our sport, again, given the efforts of the pioneers, your father especially, Gary, are just great. It puts our sport in a real good stead. All courses, pretty much, if they are following the certification, you know, protocol can be, you know, known to be that distance. So from the race director side of the running community, it's wonderful, wonderful stuff that we have in place. I'll leave you with, again, a thought I just expressed a moment ago. The more collaboration that can be done between the directors, designers of courses, and the measurers, I think it's just going to help the product in the long run. So I thank you for letting me participate, and sorry I've got to jump off at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay. Pete, you've outlined some of the, you know, your things you were most proudest of regarding uniting the measurers over the years and the establishment of the 1,000 feet or 300 meters minimum allowable length for calibration course. Maybe just talk on that a little bit, just reflections on some of that.
Okay, I'll try to be as brief as I can. I started in the business when I became a runner. It didn't take long for me to realize that your performance didn't mean doodly if the course wasn't right. My first marathon, a friend of mine, Ben Buckner, told me, he's a professor of surveying, he said that course is too long. And I said, it is? I'd run a 335 on it, and I had wanted to run a 330 for Boston. So I got USGS maps, and I walked dividers over it, and I got a pretty good map measurement of the course that showed it to be a mile and a half too long. And on the basis of that, Jacques Semple let me into Boston. It tickled me. It was a good thing to happen. But that got me interested in measurement. I also published a couple of I made a little slide rule that helped you predict your time from times at other distances, and also wrote an article that had a formula in it that people still use today. When I was sending courses into TED, he was just in the process of stopping doing it all himself. It was a titanic load he was carrying. And he decided he's going to shop it out among some other guys who got it and see if he could set up a system of state certifiers. Ben Buckner, the guy I started learning from, was Ted's first choice for Ohio, but he didn't want the job. And he asked me to put in for it. I did, and Ted said, okay, you're the Ohio certifier. I wrote a set of measurement instructions based on Ted's instructions, and they were in place about a year before we got around to writing a measurement book. I think they probably, I wasn't in on writing the measurement book directly. Well, yeah, I guess I probably was. But anyway, I got in there first. But what I really liked doing was putting out measurement news, because up until that time, we were just a fragmented bunch of guys, loosely connected in a way, because we all dealt with Ted, but Ted was so damn busy, he didn't have time to be fooling around writing letters to everybody. Well, I did have the time, so I started putting out this newsletter, and first thing I knew, it was going all around the world, and I did it for about 130 issues every other month, and I think it helped people a lot, but it was mostly done for my own pleasure, though. The thing is, I got into this because I liked doing it. I didn't do it for anybody else. This was something that I got a big kick out of, and I really felt privileged to be where I was. That's so much for the communication. Back when we started, in the in the early 80s, calibration courses were supposed to be a kilometer or half a mile. Well, if anybody has ever measured a calibration course, you'll do anything to avoid having to steel tape half a mile, let alone trying to find a straight road that long. This, I felt, was an impediment to good measurement, because if people couldn't find a calibration course, they couldn't measure. I can remember there was a 3,000-foot calibration course on top of a dam around near Columbus, and I had used that a time or two. But then in Measurement News, I asked a bunch of people, hey, why don't you lay out this test course and do some rides? And seven or eight people did, and we found that we could get results that were almost, not exactly, but almost as good if you went all the way down to 1,000 feet instead of half a mile. And we said, let's give this thing a try. I was the boss at the time, the chairman, so I could say it. I said, okay, let's try this out and see how it works. And first thing you know, we're using it. And as I recall, nobody ever said this temporary thing is now permanent. It just seemed like such a good idea to everybody that now we're getting calibration courses out the yin-yang where before we didn't have them. I think that was a good thing. Okay. The rest of the stuff that I've done is all well documented in all the literature. I created that archive that I by simply scanning all the reports and stuff that people had sent me. I think it's valuable. I don't know what else to say, and I feel like I've blown my own horn enough. Thanks for the opportunity, and I think that I hope Ted is pleased with what we're doing.
Yeah,
that's it for me.
Yeah. Questions, comments for Pete?
Hi, this is Alan Jones. I again want to thank Pete for coming up with the modification of the Jones counter, because we just couldn't get the parts anymore. If he hadn't taken the bull by the horn, I don't know where we'd be today. The fellow that was making them out in San Francisco couldn't get the parts, and Pete just stepped in there and did what had to be done.
We spent considerable time and money developing that, my son and I, and it's got a few wrinkles that we don't like. We get some problems with broken tabs, but we're working on it, and it was a good thing to do, but it wasn't done out of the kindness of our hearts. I thought, well, hell, here's a chance for my son to make some money. So we got together, we put it in, and basically it's a business.
All right.
But I don't want anybody getting me confused with Albert Schweitzer. It's a good thing. And it was something that I have to say that I learned a lot from Ted. But early on, Bob Letson, conspicuously absent from this, was an enormous good influence on me. He had dealt with Ted a lot. He knew the ins and outs. I learned so much from that guy, I can't think of them all. And so I'm taking my hat off to him. I wish he was in this thing now. And I hope, Gary, that you can get him to say something.
Yes, I had some contact with him a couple years ago, so I'm trying. I'm working on it. Could you just both you, Pete and Alan, just talk a little and Clayne about the enhancements to the counter that occurred?
You mean the changes we made?
Yes.
Well, we found that the old counter depended on another company being in business making odometer, speedometers for bikes. They had a little dial on the handlebars and a cable that ran down to the front wheel, and it was all mechanical. Well, after a while, these guys went out of business. They got driven out of business by the electronic odometers, which were a hell of a lot cheaper and worked just fine. Well, That's okay for the, you know, the bike riders, but we needed those drive units. You could buy the whole electronic odometer and throw away the part that's on the handlebar, and we had the piece we needed to stick the counter into, and we've got a counter. The drive mechanism was all purchasable off the shelf. But once those guys went out of business, we knew that we would soon be out of business as measurers, because we wouldn't have any gizmo to put on our bikes. So my son and I got our heads together. We did a lot of design work, and what we wound up with, you can see on our webpage at jonescounter.com. Tells all about what we did and the prototypes we made, and I'm glad it's still going. It drives us crazy when Vita Root keeps raising the price on those counters, but we can't do anything about it, and people seem to think it's still worth it. God knows why. I mean, when you think of $140 for a counter that costs $13 or $14, a hundredfold increase. No, wait, that's not a hundredfold. That's tenfold. Price going up 10 times, that's not trivial. And we'd love to have a cheaper price, but we can't do it unless we give our work away, and we won't do that.
Yes, in the early days, Claim could get them in quantity for $3.98 a piece. I don't know what you're paying now. But the other thing that Pete did, along with those improvements, he turned the counter 90 degrees, so you don't have to crank your head to the side to read the numbers anymore. You can read them by looking straight down at it. That's a big advance. Thanks, Pete.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And I just want to add that Pete and his son is one of the most responsive companies I've ever dealt with in my entire life. You put an order in and you can get the thing in a day or two if you need it. And I have been on several occasions, as Pete knows, a mule carrying counters over to Europe and in the Far East for other people. So it's thank you so much for your work, Pete, and your son. It's a great product.
Thank you, Dave.
Pete, your son's name is?
My son's name is Tom.
Tom, okay, great.
And you'll see it on the webpage. There's a picture of him putting a counter together.
Okay, great. Other thoughts or questions for Pete? Any additions to the call, Bob Thurston or Roy Perron? Okay, so we're doing good on the time front. Excuse me?
This is Roy.
Roy, hi. Good to have you on the call. Roy, talk about your involvement with cost measurement. What got you started, and you're currently active on committees. Talk about that some.
Okay, I originally got started because there were no cost measurers in Wisconsin, and I got that started. And I didn't have time to do it myself, but I got involved with some others, and eventually we got our own cost certifier. I saw the need after I had supposedly broken a record and it didn't get ratified because there was no course measurement. I've had a number of records. I've gotten ratified. I've got 66 records ratified, but I probably have 10 to 12 that never did get ratified. And I felt that was a shame, not only for myself, but for others as well. And we're still having problems with a lot of our athletes, specifically ultra running. I was told by the records keeper that Masters ultra running athletes account for about 50% of the records that he processes every year. So I saw a need that we need to continually strive to get race directors to properly measure and certify their course, get the sanctions, etc. So I'm developing a document that we can post specifically for ultra runners, but I'm sure it'll be available for others, on what's needed to actually get a record. And the course measurement is a big majority of that, including setting marks and route. You need to have those pre-certified marks out there, especially when you're doing a track. And people don't realize that on a track, if you reverse directions, that mark may be on the other side of the track when you reverse directions every 3 or 4 hours in a time race like 12 hours or 24 hours. So there's still a need for information out there. I still serve with the Moton Ultra Trail Running Council, and I'm also a member on the Athletes Advisory committee, and I serve both of those committees as representative to the Road Running Technical Committee and the Records Committee. They go hand in hand as far as I'm concerned. And again, I think it's more of an educational thing, and all the information is out there, but it's not really in one concise place. So I'm trying to create a document that someone can say how to set a record, how to get a record ratified, and have that out there for them. So that's my two cents. Thanks, Gary.
Any comments, what Roy was just talking about? Questions?
This is Clayne. Roy, I'm curious how you certify or calibrate a trail course that has, you know, bumps and rocks and turns on it that road running courses don't have.
Do not typically certify it. We measure it. Some of them are using GPS. Some of them are actually using wheels. And we're getting it accurate to the best of our abilities, with the course being at least the distance stated. We cannot set records on a trail. So it's not a certified course by any means. We found out years ago that Western States 100 was actually on the short end, and it was on the long side. So now it's fairly accurate. But we do have people that actually will measure the entire length of a 50-mile trail course and get them as accurate as possible.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Any other questions, thoughts? Okay.
Thanks for the trip down memory lane.
Well, yes.
I just want to add one thing. The one thing that has changed in course measuring, the one thing that's golden and very, very helpful to all course measurers is Google Earth.
Oh,
and
the reason why
I say that is, for all of us who measure, when we would have to go out to calibrate to fabricate a course, we would spend days measuring segments of the course, and then going and piecing it together, and then doing the final measurements. Now we can do this in just a few minutes on Google Earth. We can come up piecing the course together with relative accuracy, not the accuracy that we require for course certification, but it saves us tremendous amount of time in developing a course. And it also helps eliminate major errors, because you know where your mile marks are going to basically fall when you do this course creation on Google Earth.
Oh, right.
Also, Google Earth provides your elevation data for your certificate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. Yes, to a certain degree. Yes.
Well, technology's been a huge help to us. I mean, back when some of us started, they didn't even have handheld calculators. Then now all of a sudden you got the Xerox machine, mapping programs, the computer. I mean, we've got things that make our jobs so much easier than it was back in the good old days.
Yeah.
Exactly, Pete, but we still use a great Jones counter, and it's the same basic method. All that other stuff is going to enhance us and make our life easier.
I think we also have a problem with runners carrying their own Garmin and their GPS system and coming in flying and saying the course is too short or the course is too long. And you try to explain to them things like tangents and short course factors, and they don't get it. They just say it's too short or it's too long.
Hey, and speaking of that, those people with the GPS on their arms are not always wrong. There was a big brouhaha that I heard about out on a marathon course in Maui where the people were screaming because the course was too short. And I had no role in it, so I was just one of the people carbon copied. But I ran it through Google Earth, and I came up with about the better part of a mile short for the marathon, and correspondingly for the half marathon. Somewhere along the line, somebody made a mistake. It wasn't just bad riding, but there's a bunch of pissed off people out there, and I don't know how it got resolved. I just backed out of it. I never even told them that was what I had come up with. I just figured, hey, this is not, I don't have a dog in this fight.
Well, Peter, you mentioned something that's really very, very important that you and Ted and everybody else helped establish, the fact that we require two measurements. you know, measure twice, cut once. And
well, I don't know how many measurements got made. I never really I'm retired from the game. I'm an old man, and I'm kind of looking back fondly at what the young folks are doing and how we used to do it and all that other BS. So this is just one of the problems that I used to deal with. And I'm retired. I don't want to make a pain in the neck of myself. And so I thought, let them work it out. I never did hear how it got worked out.
Gary, may I quickly tell the story of the Lake Pontchartrain Causeway marathon?
Sure. Yes.
Back in 1978 or 79, the Roadrunners Club of America hosted their national marathon down in New Orleans. And your dad was down there.
Yeah.
And I was down there because I was timing the event. And the race started and finished outside of the city of New Orleans. And the day or so before the race, the police went on strike and prohibited the organizers from using the marathon course. So everybody scrambled around trying to figure out what to do. And at the 11th hour, they got permission to use the Lake Pontchartrain Causeway, which at that time was the longest bridge in the world at 23.83 miles long. And the race was, the finish line was about a mile and a half from the south end of that bridge. So they figured, well, we can approximate the distance from the end of the bridge to the finish line, and that's all we had to do was tack on what we needed at the beginning. And I said, you really can't do that for a marathon. We need to measure it. So I found somebody that had a Jones counter, found a bicycle in some backyard, and we measured from the end of the bridge because we knew where the hash marks were designating the bridge. And we measured the finish line, and then we knew how much we had to add to the start. And Ted was there, and he said, would you award it certification? I said, no, because it was only one measurement. We needed to have a verifying measurement. And we also needed to make sure that the hash marks that I used designating the end of the bridge were actually the 23.83 miles long. So we get documentation from the engineers who built the bridge. And, of course, Ted farmed that information out to people who understood it better than himself, which one was Bob Letson. Bob reads the documentation and sends back a note saying that the engineers would never reach land because the latitude and longitude that they listed was incorrect and wouldn't reach land. And the engineers admitted that they had made a typo on the document. So the fact of the matter was that another great Letson story of finding a needle in a haystack.
Was that the same race where they wound up having a tornado of a tailwind?
Well, it wasn't a tornado.
Faster than hell.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call it a tornado, but they had a tailwind of about 30 miles per hour, and the gentleman who won it, his PR was previously 2:15, and he ran a 2:11. So they decided they were going to do the race again next year the same way, but unfortunately the wind was in the opposite direction, and people ran about 30 minutes slower.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, let me just say I want to thank all of you. You've been tremendous stewards of this end of our sport. And, that started with John Jewell and John Sterner and Aldo Scandura and Ted Corbett. And this call and all is a testament to that pioneering work and all the work that you've done. I'm going to end it, the recording. Hold on 1 second.